Welcome to the 2014 Annual Bar Luncheon. It's great to see so many people out, and I'm really excited about today's program. I'd like to take all the credit for this, but I can't. I want to introduce Hunter Shurtleff was also very instrumental in this, wherever Hunter is. Davis Watson back there, and David Pulling. So these guys have done a lot of work behind the scenes. I'm here to speak because I've been considered the face guy, so I'm going to take all the credit for that. We have two speakers today. First, we have Jonathan Smaby, who is, by all authorities, a very interesting and funny speaker on legal ethics. I have it on good authority from multiple sources that this will be very enjoyable, no pressure, and that'll start roughly in about an hour. After that, we'll have Coach. He'll speak after Coach Leach. After Coach Leach speaks, we're going to take, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes to take care of some bar business, and then we'll start with Mr. Smaby's presentation, which will include about an hour of CLE, and we will get you that information. And speaking of CLE, those that attended Shane Phelps's program last month, we will be getting you information for that. That was a great program. Thank you, Shane. And we'll be getting those numbers to you shortly. I guess the question that I've been getting a lot is, how did we get Coach Leach here? And a lot of us are excited. Thank you, Coach, for showing up. And we needed a speaker, and we were struggling, so we said, well, let's just go ahead and shoot for the stars. And we knew that Judge Brian knew Coach Leach, and in particular, we knew that he was friends with Coach Leach's mentor, I think it's safe to say, a gentleman named Hal Mummy, that was kind of the godfather of the spread air raid offense. And so I went to Judge Brian's office and just asked him, Judge, how about getting Coach Leach for our bar luncheon? And to his credit, thank you, he didn't laugh. And this is the way it played out. He pulled out his cell phone, put it on his desk, adjusted his bifocals, and in a matter of 5 seconds, maybe six, I kid you not, you hear Coach Mummy's voice and he goes, well, hello, Judge. So at that point, I figured we were in good shape, and we were kind of off to the races there. I'm very excited to have our first speaker, Coach Leach. I'm a long-suffering Red Raider fan. Being a Red Raider fan is kind of like being a Cubs fan, and it was unfortunate the way things happened with Coach Leach. The way it went, when it happened, and I don't, if you'll indulge me briefly on this, I was on a beach in Mexico with my family, and I get all these text messages that Coach Leach has been suspended or whatever. And long story short, after about, I guess I thought I was a Rockefeller or something because I'm on my cell phone keeping up with things at all the message boards. And the second day of doing this, my wife asked me what my roaming plan was, and I didn't know what it was. And in fact, it was I got a call from AT&T when I got back home, and I kid you not, it was $963. But And this is not a plug for AT&T. They allowed me to get a retroactive international plan. So consider that with you determining your next carrier. And the reason I say that is because I am not unique in the way that, as a Red Raider fan, I thought of Coach Leach. I was very, very distraught when it happened. And as Josie Wells might say, we all died a little that damn day. And anyway, Coach, I just want to say welcome back to Texas. And I wish you'd never left. So thank you, Coach. And now, for the man that made all this responsible, Judge Brian, if I could say something briefly about Judge Brian. It's not often you get to say great things about it or good things about a judge in front of people, but most of y'all know him. For y'all that don't, he graduated from A&M, from Baylor Law School, came back home to Bryan, and is a city councilman as a kid. He was elected DA at a very, very young age. Then he was in his own firm for a good number of years, and he routinely kicked my teeth in when I was on the opposite side, as he did to many others, but I'll say that he did it with a great deal of charm, and he has since run for judge. I guess it was 8 years ago. Nobody ran against him. Nobody's run against him since, and I think that is a testament to the regard in which people hold him, and the way he treats people in and out of the courtroom, both his patience and his fairness. So I'll introduce Judge Bryan.
Thank you. I want to introduce Gardner Parker. Gardner, stand up. He's an old Bryan boy. Gardner graduated from high school here in Bryan. He's a prominent businessman in Houston, and Gardner helped us a bunch getting Mike here today and drove him up here today, along with Matt Hamill. Thank you, Gardner. First time I ever heard Mike's name, I was talking to Hal Mummy on the phone about coming to Bryan to be the head high school coach. And Hal was coaching at a little school called Iowa Wesleyan, a Division III college in Iowa. And I was asking him about his coaching staff up there on the phone, and he mentioned only one other coach. I've since learned maybe they had more than one other one, but Mike Leach. That's the first time I ever heard his name. That was back in about 1991. And I said, well, how do y'all divide up your duties? He said, I coach the backs, and Mike coaches the line, and Mike does the laundry. So Mike is a native of Cody, Wyoming. That's where he says he's from because that's where he went to high school, although he moved around and lived in several places. His dad was in the forestry service. And he used to stay up late talking to his mother into the wee hours of the night. And they would talk, and she would read him books about pirates and about Geronimo. And he's got a book out called Swing Your Sword that's sort of related to the pirate interest that he has. And also a new book called Geronimo. Mike is obsessed with Geronimo and has studied the Indian chief for a long time and has now written a book about him. And I'm reading his book, Swing Your Sword, right now, and it's very good. If you haven't tried it, get a copy. It's very interesting. And I'm sure Geronimo will be too. Anyway, Mike and Hal went down and coached at Valdosta State. And I visited, took my son down there to the summer camps and got to knowing Mike down there. And then Hal and Mike moved to the University of Kentucky, where Mike was the offensive coordinator for several years, and coached Tim Couch, who was the number one draft choice. And he was also, he was number one draft choice, runner-up Heisman candidate. They played University of Florida every year at Kentucky, and Bob Stoops was the defensive coordinator. So when Bob Stoops got the head job at Oklahoma, he wanted to hire the guy who'd been running the offense for that was hardest for Florida to stop. That was Kentucky's offense. So he hired Mike Leach as his offensive coordinator. Mike came in there and recruited a junior college quarterback named Josh Heupel from Snow Junior College in Utah. And the rest is history. Heupel came down there and was also, I think, a runner-up Heisman Trophy person. And Mike then left, took the head job at Texas Tech, and Heupel guided Oklahoma the next year, running Mike's offense one more year with Mike not there anymore, and they won the national championship. Mike went to Texas Tech and installed this air raid offense, which to me is the most interesting, entertaining offense in college football today. Mike and Hal Mumme started that offense back at Iowa Wesleyan, and Mike still runs it today. Texas A&M runs it, and it sort of turned the football world upside down. It attacks the entire field. That's one feature of it, and they distribute the football out to talented players in space and allow them to do their thing and move the ball downfield. They have wide splits in the offensive line. There are a lot of facets to it that are really interesting. But it has taken the football world by storm. There are people running it all over America now, and it has really taken Texas over. Either the air raid or various variations of it. Will Compton's here today. Will is our new head coach here at Rutter High School. Will told me that he's going to run the air raid. So, you know, the interesting thing about Mike is that going against Texas A&M, who had better talent than he did every year, Mike was, I believe, 7-3 against the Aggies. He put a 56-17 defeat on A&M, which is the largest margin of defeat A&M ever suffered to Texas Tech. And not only that, he was a tremendous entertainer. I mean, I remember some of the closest games, most exciting games in Kyle Field history were when Mike would bring his Raiders into Kyle Field, and there were several 2 or 3 point margin games, comeback wins that Mike accomplished out there. Well, Mike, after he left Texas Tech, while he was at Texas Tech, I remember watching a game in 2007 down in Austin, and the officials made a terrible call, and it cost Mike the game down there, and Mike made some pointed comments about the head referee who was from Austin after the game and received the biggest fine ever against a Big 12 head coach of $10,000. And I didn't think that was right or fair, but nevertheless, he got that fine, and a bunch of his fans in Lubbock raised $5,000 to help him pay the fine. And he ended up donating the money to buy hams for the poor families there around Lubbock. And then he went on to a bowl game, and the referee in the bowl game called grounding calls against him when he was in his own end zone or during the game. And they approached Mike after the game hoping to bait him and get another criticism of the referee. And he said, "No, I don't criticize officials anymore. I just give away hams." Mike was out of football, I guess, for a couple of years. And he lived down at Key West, and I asked Hal how he was doing. He said, "Well, he's just riding his bicycle down in Key West." And then he got the head job for the Washington State Cougars, where he is today, and he's building that program up. He went 3-9 his first year and then 6-7 last year and went to a bowl game. Mike is one of the most entertaining football coaches and interesting people I have ever met. It's just He doesn't give you the normal coach speak. He gives you his true thoughts on any subject you want to bring up. And he's agreed to speak today and leave about 15 or 20 minutes for questions at the end. And I said, "Would you like to take questions?" He said, "Yes, the nastier the better." So don't hold any of your questions you want to ask him. Mike is married to Sharon for 32 years. They have a wonderful marriage. They have 4 children. The two oldest ones are very accomplished. One of them, I think, is a doctor. Is that right, Mike? medical doctor. The other one is a school teacher, and then he has a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old. He's a graduate of BYU and Pepperdine Law School. He came out of Pepperdine, and he decided that he would rather be a coach. So he took a job right out of law school, came home and told his wife. She said, "How much does it pay?" He said, $3,000. And she said, "Well, that'd be good to make $3,000 a month." He said, "No, $3,000 a year." So Mike coached at a little school, and then he went on to Iowa Wesleyan, probably didn't make much more than that. And now he's one of the most popular, well-known coaches in America today. And whenever he plays, I watch the game because I know something good is going to happen. He's one of my favorite coaches in college football. And Mike, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence today and coming up here and speaking to our Bar Association and all of our other interested people here. I give you Mike Leach.
All right, well, thanks a lot. It's it's really an honor to be here. I got the wrong paper out of my pocket. We'll put that one in. It's really an honor to be here, and honestly, I've always loved this part of the state. You know, you go into Kyle Field, and all those people are yelling, "Hey, Mike, how you doing? You know, good to have you." You know, I mean, some of the friendliest receptions I've ever experienced is right down the road here, obviously. And then, it's always been a program I greatly admired. And then, you know, in any time you do one of these speaking things, you know, it's always like, it's always, well, how did you get here? Or how did you end up here? And, well, how I ended up here really you know, we finished spring football, and as you finish spring football, there's kind of a withdrawal. And so I'm hanging around the house, and my wife Sharon is who's a fantastic person. You know, has me doing this, that, and the other thing, and then she can tell I'm getting a little upset and dissatisfied with you know, just doing the menial stuff around the house. And so then she says, "I'll make it up to you." And I'm thinking, "Oh, okay, this will be great." Well, and so she, you know, she takes me by the hand, takes me back to the bedroom. She undresses and she says, "Okay, now tie me to the bed," which I do, okay? and then she says, "You can do whatever you want." So I thought, "No, what do I..." Well, then I hopped on a plane and I flew to Bryan, Texas, you know, so here I am. But I'll tell you one thing I always love. I mean, you know, football's got kind of a version of you know, it doesn't matter what you do, like you know, what business you're in. I mean, there's just venues that if you have the opportunity to play there and be a part of it, it's ridiculously exciting, and Kyle Field's one of them. You know, you go there with that many people, and it's the most vertical stadium perhaps that I've been in, and I was always excited just to know that I had the opportunity to be a part of a game that existed there, and it was always a tremendous thrill for me and hopefully for my team, because, you know, win, lose, good or bad, you can always say, yeah, I mean, I had the opportunity to coach a game or play a game in Kyle Field, which is a ridiculously impressive place. And then, you know, on the other thing that I think, and this is a little more difficult crowd, if you just talk about, you know, football or something, or to, you know, I'm in the middle of a bunch of attorneys here, you know, and attorneys know a little bit about everything. And so sometimes because I, you know, we're all kind of the same from the standpoint, you know, an attorney will read the back of a cereal box or, you know, I mean, and they're a little bit aware of darn near everything. And so, you know, typically when you speak, you got a little bit of an advantage. You know a little bit more than your audience maybe. But the trouble is, in this room, that's not necessarily the case. But when I went to law school, and I went to law school right after I graduated, I didn't have any attorneys in my family. And my dad hated attorneys, which may be part of the reason I went to law school. And so I go, I went to undergrad, and I'm in law school when I'm 22 years old. And I thought that's the way everybody did it, you know. And as I got there, it's more of a it's more of a mid-20s, early 30s crowd. And me and this fellow from Michigan State would go around and. Because we were the youngest guys there, and we would just flat out go up to people and ask them how old they were, because we wanted to jealously guard the fact that we were the youngest guys there, because we were only 22. But one thing I discovered there at law school is you're studying and you're going like crazy, is there needs to be, a little bit of a balance in your life. And I went to Pepperdine University, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous campus. But everybody here knows this. Once you get inside of a law school, doesn't matter what it looks like on the outside. On the inside, they're all the same. You know, there's a bunch of books, and there's incredibly intense people. It looks a little more fun on the outside than it is on the inside. So on the outside, it looked like Baywatch. And on the inside, it truly was... a law school in the tradition that law schools exist. And then, anytime people are go through the grinder and there's that kind of pressure, I mean, every weakness that a person has is exposed. I mean, you would see people drink more. You would see people develop drug habits. I remember one guy from back east. He always had guys in leather jackets coming through the law school looking for him because he was a big gambler, and they're collecting money from him. And then, of course, it also brings out the best in you because you discover you're capable of doing a little more than you thought and learning a little more than you expected. But I do remember one guy, and which did reinforce to me that you better kind of keep track of having a little bit of a balance. And this guy was he was a little different than me. I mean, this guy kind of dressed like Clark Kent every day in law school. I mean, kind of the suit and slacks guy, and had the horn-rimmed glasses, and seemed far more squared away as far as law went than I did. And then he was dating a granddaughter of one of the big national chains. And, she broke up with him. And after she broke up with him, he's running, they find him running down Pacific Coast Highway. He's running down Pacific Coast Highway at 5 o'clock. Pacific Coast Highway is just slammed. I mean, it's right on the ocean. They don't have enough space to put a freeway, so it's just jammed with traffic. And he's running down Pacific Coast Highway at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, naked, yelling, "I love law, I love law, I love law." And so then they had to ship him back home, and he went to an institution of some sort. But and so I figured I didn't want to turn out quite like that. And of course, we used to say that to reinforce each other, as it would get tough, or you were, reading something really fascinating like contracts or wills and trusts, you'd say, somebody'd shout out, "I love law." You'd go, "You gotta love the law." Well, to just kind of reinforce your resolve. And then at the time, there was a guy named Jerry Spence who was one of the best attorneys in America, and I'm from Wyoming, and so anybody from Wyoming, we ought to have some kind of a head nod or something, because there's not too many guys from Wyoming. We need to have a sort of a secret deal that if you're from Wyoming, you know, you convey it to the other fellow so that you have the solidarity that needs to exist there. But Jerry Spence, though, was from Wyoming, and you know, as I'm going through this, and my life's going kind of fast because, you know, it's just pretty much straight school, and I read a number of his books, and we actually lived in some of the same towns. He's older than me, but went to some of the same schools, and I wrote him a letter. I've never met him, but I wrote him a letter, and I said, dear Mr. Spence, I said, do you love law? Do you hate law? Was it worth it? You're at the top of the field of what I would like to do, and the reason I went to law school, because I was fairly idealistic. I mean, I felt like, I was going to, be a part of making the world right, keeping things on track. If the little guy was oppressed, I was going to be the guy that stood up for him. And then, of course, over time, you realize it's mainly about money. But I write Jerry Spence a letter. I said, "Dear Mr. Spence," I said, "you're at the top of the field that I aspire towards. Do you love law? Do you hate law? Was it worth it?" He says, and he sent me a letter back. He says, "Yes, I love law." He says, "Yes, I hate law." He says, "I'm consumed by law." He says, "I think about it all the time." He says, "Yes, I would do it again." And he says, "If you're consumed by law and you think about it all the time, be an attorney. If you're not, do something that you are consumed by." And it wasn't like really an earth-shattering moment. I got to thinking, well, between the channel changer, the refrigerator, and the car, I think about other things besides law, and one of them was coaching. And I started coaching baseball when I was 15 years old. In Wyoming, you could drive a car around when you were 15, which probably isn't a very good idea. And it's not something I'd necessarily recommend, especially knowing what I was like when I was 15 and being turned loose with a car. I had the opportunity to coach and got the coaching bug, I would say. And then as I got through law school, I don't want to get old and not coach. I want to get it out of my system, coach for 2 years, maybe three, and then go back and practice law. And I've been coaching ever since. And I did get consumed by it. And I do love coaching. I do hate coaching. I think about it all the time. And honestly, I'm thinking about it right now. And then and then they ask about, do you use your law degree? Yes, I do use my law degree. I use it all the time because it restructures the way you think. You think differently after you get out of law school. Essentially, you get a degree in problem solving, and in coaching, there's a ton of problems. The oversimplification is everybody thinks, well, somebody on your team gets in trouble, and so you have some knowledge on how to get them out of trouble. That'd be the least amount I ever use it. How you use it is all of a sudden, you're structuring what you do, how you're building your team, you're preparing to play somebody, and just like law and law school exams, there's not enough time to cover all of it, so you have to figure out what items and what things to focus on that'll push the needle the furthest forward. The other thing is you develop the ability to get a lot of things done quickly. And as far as figuring out how to organize all the things that go into football, I use my law degree every single day. And after you go to law school, you really don't have any choice because your thinking's adjusted in such a way that it's not going to change and you're not going to shake it from there. As far as football, my football influences. I didn't get into football in a traditional way. I played football, and you know, everybody plays football and they think they know all about football. Well, that's like saying, since I live next door to a doctor, I'm qualified to do surgery, you know. And nobody, including NFL players, everybody learns more about football than their first year when they start coaching and really analyzing it and really studying it and really seeing what goes into it. And then from law school it was, okay, well, how do I make the most out of this? Okay, I didn't, you know, like, and all businesses have, you know, a book or a routine on, well, this is done this way, not that way. This is this, that's that. Like one that I would say, and I think it's a total waste of time, is time of possession. You know, it's important to have the most time of possession. Well, no, it's not. It's important to have the most points, the most plays, the most first down, you know, because this notion that a quarterback standing behind a center, sitting there tickling his butt while you're sitting there and letting time elapse, you're really not accomplishing anything, you know. And so I wasn't, for good or for bad, and sometimes for bad, I wasn't contaminated by, well, it's always been done this way, because I didn't know how it had been done in a lot of ways. And then, so what I tried to focus on was how to maximize my resources, how to get the most out of what we had. Well, so one thing that you have is you have skill players. You know, how many guys can touch the ball? How many people can you hand the ball to? And one of the most dominant offenses at that point in time was the wishbone. Oklahoma ran the wishbone, and they were great at it. And I'm talking about my generation. I mean, there was a time, of course, A&M ran the wishbone, Alabama ran the, but in my, at that particular age, Oklahoma was a very dominant team with the wishbone. And then I'm thinking, well, but they have great players. And but then Air Force, who did not have great players, was great, and they ran the wishbone also. And so then it became, well, why is that effective? Why does that work? Well, one of the reasons it works is because everybody touches the football. Everybody, every skill position is going to touch the football. The more people that touch it, the harder it is for the defense to keep track of it. And so originally I would say that, and with Hal Mummy, and as we were at Iowa Wesleyan, and a lot of this stuff started with the wishbone. How do we make sure that everybody touches the football? The wishbone's great from sideline to sideline. It's not as good downfield as we are, but it's better downfield than people think. Because when you're running the wishbone and the triple option, as you're going downfield before you pitch it, you're able to layer that thing up and get downfield better than people realize you are. So distribution we got from the wishbone. And then the other was attack the whole field. Okay, you have 53 yards wide. And then and downfield, you don't have 100 yards. I mean, you don't have 100 yards downfield. As far as protection and things like that, you have about 30. Because you can protect and deliver a ball about 30 yards downfield. So you have 53 by 30. And it was our thinking that you ought to utilize the whole field. Utilize as much of it as you can. And Brigham Young University at that point in time was doing a really good job of attacking the whole field. And so when it came to our selection of plays and what we decided to do offensively, it was how do we allow everybody to touch the ball and how do we attack the whole field from sideline to sideline and 30 yards downfield. And then the other thing, and we used to travel all over the place. Like we might hear about some high school that had a nice little play action play. And we'd go down and watch them practice. Or we'd get in the car and we'd go to the Green Bay Packers. You know, anybody that would let us in there, we'd study football and learn as much as we could. And gathering really good plays, that's the easy part. The hard part is making the choices of what you're going to run. Because, I mean, it's really – I mean, everybody's got good plays. I mean, I can go to the junior high down the road, and they've got good plays. And they're going to have some plays that I wish we were running. But we just don't have space for them. At some point, you have to make choices, and you have to decide what you're going to be really good at. And you have to because if you're just a mishmash of stuff, you never really develop your skills around what you're trying to do. But I think it's very important to continue to learn the game. And I had a history teacher in high school that he used to say those of you to us students, he'd say, those of you that think you know it all are very annoying to those of us who do. And so anyway, from that I drew, it's what you learn after you know everything that counts. You know what I mean? And so I think there you always need to keep learning. And then I think in anything that you do, especially in running a team and a group effort, accountability is important. It's important as far as the coaches. It's important as far as the players. And we have signs hanging up on our wall in there in everybody's office. I have the biggest one, so I reinforce to myself and everybody else that this applies to me more than anything. And the sign says, you're either coaching it or you're allowing it to happen. In other words, if you want to see how good of a coach you are, turn on the film and watch your players play, because that's how good you are. And then and the players, they're a reflection of how well you coach. And I think that as a coach, you need to constantly keep in mind that you have a role in how good you are. And one thing that I've never liked is this notion of, well, I coached really well, but they didn't play good. Baloney. If they didn't play good, you didn't coach very good. Or they played great. They played great, and we did a horrible job coaching. I don't think that either. I think players and coaches go hand in hand, and the more that's reinforced and the more the unit believes that, the better they're going to work together. And then another thing is and it's tempting, and I think it all the time. I think it at times. I've said it before, but somebody won't be doing something that you want him to do, or he won't be playing the way you want him to play. And so then a guy will say, well, I've told him 1,000 times I want him to do it this way. I've told him 1,000 times. Well, if you think about it, really, you told him 1,000 times? 1,000 times, and he still won't do it. Well, you must be the worst coach in the world. I mean, if you tell somebody something 1,000 times, they still don't do it. I mean, you're a horrible coach. And so I try not to shed a bunch of light on the fact that I tell somebody 1,000 times, because and at times you need to adjust your communication with them. I've had offensive linemen. I coached O-line for 10 years, and I think that's the most important position, and it's my favorite position. And I've gotten to be known as the quarterback guy, but, the reason they have football is because of offensive line and defensive line. The reason they have it is because you get to see big people hammer on other big people, and if they can catch little people, you get to see them knock them around too. And so to me, my favorite position is offensive line. And I used to have guys, get your hips down, drop your hips, lower your pads, drop your hips. Well, and then what would happen is the guy would just bend over at the waist. I'd say, get your hips done. He'd go like this, you know. And then so finally, after a while, I said, put your head back. Well, you can't have your hips up if your head's back. So I said, put your head back. Then all of a sudden he became, you know, like I wanted him to be. And so, you know, I think as a coach or any time that you're leading a unit, I think that adjusting your communication at the appropriate time and finding ways to reach your audience is the most important thing. And I think academics and football go hand in hand. I mean, there's a lot of players that don't necessarily. I think this has gotten way out of hand. Everybody acts like players don't want degrees. Players do want degrees. And it's just the rare exception of players that don't want degrees or that they're just one-sided on just football. They may like football better, but the majority of them, whether they're academically very good or not, want to leave there with degrees. But in a lot of cases, the harder thing for some of the guys you work with is academics. And if you can get them to compete, dedicate, and focus on academics, they're going to compete, dedicate, and focus on other things too. And one of the things I've been proudest of was at Texas Tech, we had the highest graduation rate of any public institution. There were a few private ones that beat us out. We had the highest graduation rate of anybody in the top 25 a couple times. But I felt like that really fortified our team from the standpoint that they would work hard, focus in, and compete at things that weren't necessarily the top of their list of priorities. And I think it reinforced us as a team. And then if you can find a way to create accountability on everything, you're going to be better. In one way is, like, for example, if a quarterback gets sacked, I guess just to give you an illustration of my philosophy on this. If a quarterback gets sacked, well, the first conversation I'm having with the quarterback, why did you get sacked? You need to figure out some place to go with the ball. You need to move your feet, find a hollow spot in the pocket, and get rid of the ball and don't get caught with it. And, you know, and I think it's similar to occasionally there's a touchdown pass, and the offensive line keeps him out for 6 seconds. And, well, he very proudly threw his touchdown pass, and he's very happy with it. Well, they don't owe you 6 seconds. They owe you 3.5 seconds. They don't owe you 6 seconds. But you got six, and you enjoyed it. Okay, now on the off chance that they're only able to give you 2.5 seconds, you better bail them out just like they bailed you out. And then of course, the conversation in the O-line room goes something like, you know, why did the quarterback get sacked? Well, he held the ball for 6 seconds. 6 seconds, yeah, 6 seconds, that's too long. It's a long time. I mean, 6 seconds, you can't, you're going to get sacked if you hold the ball for 6 seconds. Okay, so why was it your guy then that sacked him, you know? I mean, four other guys, their guy didn't sack him, your guy sacked him. Why was it your guy that sacked him, you know? And then, of course, then there's – you got receivers and running backs, you know. Quarterback got sacked. Okay, why weren't you open? I mean, he might have thrown it to you if you were open. Why weren't you open? And I think the more you can spread that out as people work to achieve it at the highest level they can – then the more efficient your operation's going to be. We have three team goals. We used to do the team goal thing every year, and that would be gather up the team. What should our goals be? Let's vote on our goals. What do we want to have for team goals? And, you know, in the end, and they were worded differently from one year to the next, but the goals always came out approximately the same. And so then we've settled on three team goals. And then I got, you know, rather than have the meeting and have it come back articulated differently, but the same ones every year, I just settled on these are our team goals. The first one's be a team. And no matter what you do, and you can be an artist living on the side of a mountain or whatever, but everybody needs the help or the contributions of somebody else, you know. Be a team. All endeavors require cooperation. And no matter who you are and no matter what you're doing, what you do is going to require a level of cooperation. Be a team. And then, of course, don't do anything that hurts the team. We talked to our players, you know, if you do something that hurts the team, reflects negatively on the team, that affects everybody. Be the most excited to play. And there is no replacement for this. No matter what you do, be excited about it. We played Nebraska one time, and actually a fella just brought it up, but we played Nebraska, just the name Nebraska, that's not very comfortable. I mean, who do you got this week? Nebraska. Just the thought of Nebraska. I mean, they come out there, those Corn Huskers are, you know, big as can be, and, you know, act nice but are meaner than hell. I mean, and then, go up to any coach in America and tell them they're playing Nebraska, and I guarantee you that the expression on his face is going to change, and certainly the thoughts running through his head are going to. And anyway, so we're playing Nebraska, and obviously there's some anxiety with that. So we go out on the field and warm up, and I go past the corner of the end zone, or, you know, where we go up to the locker room, by the stands, and usually you can't hear anybody in the stands, but this particular time a guy calls me over. He says, this is my 85-year-old mother. She has never been to a football game before, but she likes the Red Raiders, and I just wanted you to meet her. She says, Coach, your guys are going to do great. You don't have anything to worry about. And I said, well, that's great to meet you. And I'm thinking, she doesn't know much about Nebraska, does she? And then, so then we go into the tunnel, talk to the team, and we come out, and it's kind of a stagnant first half. It's kind of a stagnant first half. And I believe the halftime score, and somebody can look it up, but I believe the halftime score was 10-7. But we scored the touchdown right before the end of the half to go in at halftime within 3 points. And our team was all fired up. And there is a certain momentum if you score right before going in at the half. And you know, Nebraska's ahead, but they're kind of ambling off the field like, you know, we gave up this touchdown. And you know, you can tell they're not real pleased. And I go by that lady again, and she says, don't worry, Coach, you guys are just fine. You're gonna win, and you guys are going to do really good. And I'm thinking, you know, we are still behind by three, but I am kind of happy. You know, we're within 3 points in Nebraska, and I know the closer we are, the longer this game goes, the better our chances are. And then, we come out again. She says the same thing. You don't have anything to worry about. And then the second half, we exploded on Nebraska. And, I mean, we literally exploded on them. We beat them 70, and I think it was 70-17. And it was the biggest loss in the history of Nebraska. As a matter of fact, playing Nebraska, Nebraska of all places accused us of running the score up on them. Now, of all the people in the whole world that have any position to accuse somebody of running the score up on them, Nebraska just doesn't happen to be one of them. And I've never done this before or since. And then I thought, you know, why was this lady so ridiculously confident about that we are going to win this game? And so I'm coming off the field, and it's a massive crowd because, you know, it's the first time, I believe it was the first time that, it might have been the first time Tech had ever beat Nebraska. And so I got to find the little old lady. I mean, I've got to get this thing sorted because she knows more. You know, she knows something about coaching I don't. And so I go find her. I said, okay. So we came out on the field, and you said you don't have anything to worry about. You guys are going to be just fine. We went in the locker room. You said don't worry about it. You're going to be just fine. Okay. We came back out at halftime. You said we're going to be just fine. I go, this is one of the best traditions and programs in the history of the world. I said, how in the NCAA? I said, you've never been to a football game. How in the world did you know that we were going to beat Nebraska? And she looks at me like I'm an idiot. And she says, well, it was easy, coach. She said, and we were the black team. The guys in the black shirts were jumping all around and couldn't wait to get out there on the field. And the guys in the white shirts, they just walked out there like they didn't want to be there. And the guys in the black shirts were so excited, it's like you couldn't even contain them in the tunnel and they couldn't wait to get out there. And sometimes you get too close to the fire. But the fact of the matter is, if it's that obvious for her, and if it's that clear for her, and she's 100% right, be the most excited to play. And the reason we won that game is because we were the most excited to play. And there's no replacement for whatever you do to be the most excited to do it. Then our third goal, so the first goal is be a team. The second one, be the most excited to play. The third one is be the best at doing your job. And no matter who you are, you have a job. You have a role. You may not like your role. You may want a different role. If you do really good at this role, you might get a different, better role. But everybody's got a job. Be the best at doing your job. And that reminds me of a fella in Cody, Wyoming. There's a hill, and it's called the Grable Hill. And that's because if you go up that hill and you drive another 60 miles, you'll hit Grable, Wyoming. And so driving up that hill, and I was in high school, and there's a fella named Todd. And Todd was a big old heavy guy, and he loved cars. And he's in this car, and the car's, you know, sloping this way. And plus it's going uphill. And he's got this really loud motor going. And we pull up beside Todd. And Todd waves at us, you know, like in high school. And he says, and he leans out the window. He says, it's a Holley, which I guess that's a carburetor that's particularly loud. I mean, I don't know much about cars. But evidently it's a carburetor that's just louder than hell. And then he revs the engine. He says, yep. He says, I just got this car and just put this carburetor on here. Couldn't wait to go out and drive it. And, you know, driving up behind him, we noticed the back wheel was kind of shimmying and shaking. And so we go, yeah, that's pretty loud. So Todd, why is your back wheel shaking around? He says, I only have 3 lug nuts on it. And then, so we drive off, and then all of a sudden, we hear this loud thump, and this kind of this crash, and Todd's tire his wheel has fallen off. He's dragging the back end of the car up the hill, and you know, of course, there's sparks and all that stuff going as it's dragging across the concrete. So, if you think that the carburetor is the most important thing about a car, or the steering wheel, or the engine, try driving it without a lug nut. Now, lug nuts cost about 50 cents, I think. And so it doesn't matter what your job is, because occasionally I'll ask the team, you can only do it about once every 2 years, because then they're on to you, but... What's the most important part of the car? Well, of course, you know, the engine, you know, and then of course, you know, the philosophy major guy, he's going to say the steering wheel or the gas pedal or something. But try driving it without a lug nut. I mean, all roles are important. And I mean, and there's nothing insignificant about it. We talk about how to achieve our goals. Got the three goals. Here's how you achieve them. Get better every day. Don't confuse activities with results. Everybody in the country is having practice. Everybody in the country is watching film. Unless we have the ability to draw more out of it than they do, that's exactly who we are, as everybody else. Now, if you expect your results to be different than everybody else, you have to have the ability to draw more out of it than they do. Just because you're involved in the activity does not mean you're going to generate the results unless you're able to distinguish yourself. Don't be afraid to be different, because that's not your goal, to be everybody else. Compete with yourself. Gauge your performance by whether it was the best of your ability. In other words, if you're the best player on the team, somewhere down the road, you're going to find somebody that's even better and better than anybody you're practicing against. And unless you're constantly working to the best of your ability and developing your skills, you're not going to put yourself in a position to prevail over a guy that's better than you. And if you're the worst player on the team and you just resign yourself to getting beat on every play without really trying, despite the fact you're going to get beat, you're not going to develop your skills and you're not going to improve. The only people that improve are the people that are committed to doing their best every play, and then they extend their capacity and improve on what they do. But if you're just going out there half speed, you're not really improving on anything, because you're not able to improve. I mean, you can already do half speed. Play the next play. That's the only one that counts. That's the only play that you can impact. And and I used to have these linemen, and a lineman would get beat on a play, and then of course the lineman, when he'd get beat on a play, you'd see him do this. It'd just be like a cartoon, except a gigantic cartoon, you know. And then, that business there, well, okay, you know, it's great that you're very concerned and disappointed in yourself on that last play, but you know what? We need you this next play, okay? And regardless of how you performed on that last play, we need you this next play. And so, no matter how great the last play was, because you'll see this too. I mean, I had a guy in a bowl game intercept a ball, run it in for a touchdown, and then the very next series he gets, and you can see he's happy, he's bouncing around. The very next series he gets hit right in the face with another football. I mean, the ball hits him right in the face. Well, he's not ready to play. You know, he didn't play the next play. He's so happy about that last touchdown, he wasn't ready to play. Could have had two of them. Could have had two touchdowns. And play the next play. And then the other thing is win one game a week. You're only allowed to play one game. Everybody would say, they'd say, well, are you ready for A&M? No, we don't play A&M till week 7. No, we're not ready for A&M. We're ready for North Texas, though, you know. And, you only have one game a week. And so they each game deserves your full focus and attention. And in our new, we got a new facility. We move into it in 10 days. Our new facility will be the best football operations building in the Pac-12. And our locker room is gigantic. But one thing we have on the wall in the middle of our locker room, it says, respect everyone and fear no one. Because you're vulnerable to anybody you don't respect, and you can't beat anybody you're afraid of. And so I think if you want to win one game a week, you need to respect everyone and fear no one. And then at my law school graduation, the fellow got up and talked to the professor emeritus, who used to be a general. He said, lawyers are problem solvers, and he says, find problems that you are passionate about and go solve them. And I think that's pretty good advice. Anyways, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and now we'll open it up to questions here.
I'm going to start with a question, kind of prime the pump.
All right. Well, I'm going to grab a water here real quick.
When you were at Kentucky, I heard the charge made that you all were just, your offense was a bunch of hindery, and it was not respected by those old SEC people like Pat Dye and so forth.
Yeah.
How do you answer the charge that what you do is hindery?
Well, obviously it's not. I mean, for one, I think the detractors have answered it themselves because the entire, you know, a bunch of the NFL's copied it. And if you look at what we've done clear back at Iowa Wesleyan, me anyway, and I'd have to say Hal too, and a bunch of people that worked with us, we haven't changed at all. We're doing the same thing we were doing essentially back then. And Super Bowl after Super Bowl's been won doing similar things. But I think the most important thing in football is execution. And that never changes. You know, the most important, what's the most important thing? It's not all this duck, dodge, run around and, you know, have some nifty, tricky little play. I mean, it literally, the most important thing a defense does is tackle. Most important thing an offense does is block. And then, as you synchronize all that together with an emphasis on that, it's execution. Now, whatever you select to do, whether it's run the ball, throw the ball, or something in between, you have to make choices so that you develop your skills, because execution is the most important thing. And no matter how football evolves, how it changes, what direction it goes, if you're any good at it, it will always be a game of execution. It will always be who can synchronize the best and who makes the choices so that they can truly develop their skills, practice after practice, and work on it. One advantage offense has over defense, and you have this advantage providing you're not foolish enough to relinquish it. And what the advantage is if you make choices and if you decide what your identity is and what you're going to do on offense, you have the ability to work on that every day. You have the opportunity to work on that every day. Defenses can't do that. The reason they can't do that is this week they're playing the option. This week they're playing somebody that throws it all the time. This week they're playing somebody that's off tackle play action. This week they're playing, this team, that team, the other team. They have to adjust the complexion of the defense and the emphasis of the defense around the varieties of offenses that they're playing. An offense doesn't really have to do that. Obviously, you have to be ready for the defense you're going to play, but the core of what you're doing is going to be your offense. And you have an advantage from the standpoint, like, for example, your X receiver. You can ensure the fact that that guy has run more corner routes than their corner has defended if you make choices and you decide what you're going to run and what you're going to play. If you're one of those guys that's going to change up the offense from one week to the next, then you've given up that as an advantage. Then your ability to reinforce and execute better than the other guy is compromised to a point.
Coach, in the book, The System, you're in three of those chapters. How do you think they trained you and your story in that book?
I've heard good. I Jeff Benedict was a great guy, and I actually kind of missed him when he was gone. He's the guy that wrote the book. I haven't read it. I mean, but I've heard it was good. I haven't read it, and part of it, I guess, is as I told the thing, I figured I knew it, but it's on my on deck circle. It's on my dresser with a whole stack of other books that I need to read, and I've been kind of preoccupied with Geronimo. Me and a fellow named Buddy Levy have just published a book, and it's called Geronimo, Leadership Strategies of an American Warrior. And we go from the beginning of his life to his death. And Buddy Levy, you may have seen, if you've ever watched Decoded or Brad Metzler's Decoded, Buddy is the historian on there. And so we had the opportunity to write this Geronimo book, and we pretty much did it kind of late February last year through July, and we're excited about the book. And I've always been fascinated by Geronimo and the Apache's ability to survive and accomplish things that other people couldn't accomplish against incredible odds. And so I've been pretty focused on that Geronimo book, which everybody needs to buy it, and I think that and make sure you sue those who don't. And so I've been kind of zeroed in on that, but I've heard it was good, and you know, and so I hope for the best.
Mike, you got some quarterbacks right where you were duplicated by the NFL. What's your thoughts about Johnny Manziel?
Well, I think he's one of the most competitive people on earth. I've never met him. I'd like to meet him. I know all his coaches. You know, starting Cliff Kingsbury to Kevin Sumlin. I know his coaches, and then he's incredibly competitive. He's illustrated the fact that he can make virtually everybody on the Alabama defense miss, and all those guys are going to the NFL. Typically, if you play defense at Alabama, you're in the NFL. And then, so I think he's an incredible talent. I think that he has to develop his ability to throw the ball, to read the field and throw it more accurately, because right now I think he's relatively average at that. I think that because the here's what's going to happen. I mean, in the end, I think that it's not if he gets injured, it's when. Because he's going to get injured, and it may not be a catastrophic injury. It may be a sprained ankle, where all of a sudden he runs like everybody else does, you know. And when that happens, he's going to have to be able to throw the ball effectively enough to sustain himself. So between now and when that day comes, he needs to continue to develop and study and read the field. What's really impressive about him is he's been able to develop the skills he has in a relatively short period of time. And, you know, accomplish what he's accomplished. I think it's good that he went to Cleveland. I doubt he planned to. I don't know. But I think it's good he went to Cleveland because I think it limits some of the distractions. I think he's at a place where if he really applies himself, he can really focus in and develop himself as a player. Because no matter who you are, you need to keep developing. And if he eliminates distractions, maintains the whole competitive edge, I think he can truly be a great player.
I went to Pepperdine Law School, and I'm not sure if we were there at the same time, but I think we were. And I remember one time, and this has to do with your Pacific Coast Highway story.
Yeah. Was it you?
Went streaking at the undergraduate graduation, and all they had on was tennis shoes and hoods over their head, and they never got caught, but there were lots of pictures. And knowing that the statute of limitations has passed, I just want to know if you had anything you wanted to tell
me. If I would have thought of it, I probably would have done it, you know. I mean, Pepperdine was quite a place. You'd go out there. And now you've definitely experienced this. You know, you hit your classes, then you go out to the cafeteria, which is on that deck overlooking the Pacific Ocean and palm trees and everything else. And as you're sitting there eating your sandwich, I mean, some of the saddest moments that existed was out there on that balcony overlooking the Pacific Ocean with palm trees, eating your sandwich or whatever, and knowing, are you going to go out and do any? No, you're going back in that library right there. And and sit in your carrel, and then with all those books sitting there, and hopefully, one of your classmates, adversaries, competitors haven't stolen the books for the assignment that you have to do. Because, I think everybody experienced this. I mean, you'd have some assignment or something. Those books would disappear. And those books wouldn't disappear because somebody's hogging the books for themselves. Those books would disappear, so they'd have a competitive advantage, you know, and all of a sudden they're not there. And so then, then, of course, you'd have to go. In my case, I'd go to the UCLA law school and use their books because they weren't on the same assignment. Yeah. Anybody else?
Coach, yours and Bill Belichick's news conferences are the most entertaining. Can you tell us your philosophy about the post-game news conferences?
Well, I try to be honest so there's less to keep track of, you know. because, if you're not truthful, you have to remember all the untruthful things you said and who you said it to. So I try to eliminate trying to keep track of things. I try to be honest. I mean, and then, and then also try to remember, be a team. It's it's us together, and what's going to make us the best is key. But the other thing is, and I was in the media for a little bit. I was on Sirius for 2 years, Sirius Radio for 2 years, and then it was CBS for a year. And the media is not really an adversary, because the media, there's the sense that they just like bad news. That's not really true. They're a little bit like realtors. They just want action. They don't care if it's good news or bad news, and I got a couple realtors in my family. They don't care if the market's up or down. They just want people flipping houses, People can sell them because they're losing money, or people can sell them because they think they're going to make money. It doesn't matter. I mean, and the media is a little like that too. They don't care if it's good news or bad news. They just want some kind of news, But, as far as the press conferences, I'm not 100% conscious of it. They ask you a question, you answer it. But then there's a little bit, there's a little bit of the occasional Bill Clinton deal to the thing. They'll ask you something, and instead of answering it, you talk about whatever you want to instead, So.
Wes Walker wasn't really recruited at all. When did you realize he was actually pretty good?
Well, I thought he was going to be. Wes Walker was an interesting, and I would love to say that we had it all sorted and we were brilliant. I mean, we got. I think we were smarter than average, but we also got lucky too. It was the first year at Tech. And we didn't have a complete class because, you get there in January and you try to recruit the best class you can. And giving away all 25 scholarships can be hard, especially to quality people. And so we had this film on Wes Welker, went to a private school in Oklahoma City. And, it was a heck of a film. And I'm not and I might be shortchanging him as much as – I mean, this is as accurate as I know, and he might be getting shortchanged on what I'm about to tell you. But on that film, okay, he had like 60 yards rushing. He had like 260 yards receiving. He had like 3 touchdowns receiving. He had a punt return was better for him than kickoff return, but he had some long punt returns, but he had a kickoff return or two for a touchdown. He had a couple. He had some tackles. He had he had some tackles. He had, I think he had an interception, and then at the end of the game, and I'm not kidding you, at the end of the game, he hits a 53-yard field goal to win it, And so, well, as you're watching that film, because, you know, Wes is short and slow, and he's still short and slow to this day, and everybody says, well, how fast is Wes Welker? Well, Combine had him at 4.8, and that's about what he is. He's a 4.8 guy, but he's real good laterally. He was all-state soccer. He could explode out of his cuts. He had coordination on both sides of his body. And I know that it's real fashionable for football coaches to bash on soccer. Every soccer guy that I've had has done well for me. And I've actually thought about, almost did it at Tech. I'm rolling it through my head at Washington State, about forcing my team in the off season to sign up for intramural soccer. Because you figure the big guys, they're going to get pretty good feet. And then the other thing, and I always wondered why he had such great vision. But, you know, if you're a soccer guy, and first of all, it develops lateral movement, you're fast at coming out of your cuts, you have to be more coordinated to your left side, say, than you would be otherwise. Okay, and he had such good vision carrying the ball. Well, as I think about it, if you're sitting there with a ball around your feet, trying to, with your peripheral vision, figure out what one of your buddies you're gonna kick the thing to, well, now all of a sudden you're holding it. Well, you can really see good then. And so I think it really developed his peripheral vision. And so he was an all-state soccer guy, but we'd watch that film and we'd say, wow, that's a good play. Wow, he's really a good high school player. If only he was bigger. If only he was faster. If only, if only, if only. Well, then in the end, we felt like he'd be a good team guy. And so we went ahead and offered him. And because he had no scholarship offers. Tulsa thought about offering him but didn't. Oklahoma told him he couldn't walk on there. They didn't have space for him to walk on. Oklahoma State said, you can walk on, but we're not going to scholarship you. And then, you know, so we scholarshiped him, we got him, and then he started the first game that he ever played there, played 4 years, left as the leading receiver in the history of the school and the all-time leading punt returner in the history of college football. So he did a pretty good job.
You had great success developing quarterbacks, and they all haven't been necessarily NFL quality quarterbacks. But what do you look for in a quarterback, and then what do you do special to kind of bring them up to your speed?
I think that, and I've been lucky enough that a lot of them have played and, you know, have gone to the NFL, but they haven't started, and then. You know, in some cases, I think the NFL's just wrong, and in some cases, there's other guys that are just better physically, you know. I think that what I look for and what I think is the most important thing is I think they have to be accurate, and, you know, and I get a kick out of these guys that say, well, you know, he's a really good quarterback. He's going to be great in college, but all he's got to do is work on his accuracy. And then all of a sudden in college, well, he's going to be really good in the NFL. All he's got to do is work on his accuracy. All he's got to do is work on his accuracy. I mean, that's not the last thing you work. That's the first thing, you know. I mean, there's an open guy. Can you hit him? Well, if you can't hit him, you can't play quarterback, you know. I mean, all he's got to do is work on his accuracy. Why not get one that's accurate? You know, somewhere there's a shortstop that may not – have any business being quarterback, but I'll bet you can hit that guy and we're going to be better off, you know. And so I think number one's accuracy. Number two is good decisions. You know, can he deliver the ball to the guy that he selects, okay? And then is he good at selecting which guy to throw the ball to? And that's a little bit harder to sort because on film you don't know what their coaches taught him to do. I look for guys that throw the ball on the break, you know, rather than wait for the guy to be wide open. If he's throwing a lot of balls on the break, I think that's a sign that he makes good decisions. I think if you can see him scan the field and check down, that's an indication he makes good decisions. And then also when I bring him in and talk to him, I try to get, you know, what he's looking at out there off of his film. You know, you get one of his films and say, all right, what are you looking at here? What are you looking at there? Then after that, Well, then there's the other qualities, which quick feet. I like quick feet. I think is important because it sustains your position in the pocket. And then after that is strong arm or fast. I think a guy's got to be able to throw it 45 yards or better without it fluttering. Beyond that is handy. If you get, you know, if some guy can throw it 70 yards, that's handy, but that's really for broken plays, because you can't protect consistently for receivers to get 70 yards downfield. So it'd be something like if the guard gets whipped and quarterback rolls out, and then as he finds space, looks downfield, and the routes have extended down there, or if he's done a bad job of reading the field and just holds the ball. But it's handy, but it's beyond 45 yards, it's a broken play. And then, if you think about it, the five things I mentioned, accurate, good decisions, quick, strong arm, fast. I mean, you go through the NFL Hall of Fame, there are none of them that have all five of them. So you try to get the balance of, but the first two I don't compromise on. And then a quarterback's biggest role is to make the other players around him better. And sometimes that's kind of an intangible thing, because there's guys that are physically more talented than others that aren't as good at making the players around them better. Because, you know, as a quarterback, you deal the ball off, and selecting when to do that, who to do it with, how to do it, and then just sort of a presence in the huddle can accelerate the play of everybody else. The guy that's best at that is the best quarterback.
What words of wisdom did you have for Cliff Kingsbury before he took the job at Tech?
You know, it's a little bit like getting married. I mean, there's no real preparation for it. I mean, because you get in there, and it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different world. I mean, the good news is you get to decide, and nobody cuts your drills off. It's not like, well, time's up, okay, next period. No, I mean, you get to have your period as long or as short as you want. You know, nobody cuts off your drills. If you need an extra play or you want to cut it by five plays, I mean, that's probably the best part, okay? The hardest thing is the balancing act. You don't overreact or underreact to stuff, kind of balance it out. And then basically I said, call me anytime I can help you, which he does on occasion. I saw him the other day. I had a book signing in Lubbock, signed 700 books, and went and saw Cliff beforehand. So that pretty much put me in the Red Raider mood, because he was the first, I remember, he was the first quarterback. We talked about this. we talked about this. And I've shown this to my quarterbacks since, but he played that first year, my first year there, he was a starting quarterback against A&M, and he threw for 330 yards, but he got hit hard 22 times, got drilled 22 times. So many times these quarterbacks go soft or tentative or, start whining about something. I have broken out that A&M film of of the Aggies just knocking the hell out of Cliff. You know, you think you got it rough. Look at this. Look at this. Look at this. And then one of the best completions I've ever seen in my life was in that game. And we're running a crossing pattern. Okay, so a guy hits him down here by his knees. A guy's already hitting, engaged and hitting him by his knees. Another guy's hitting him here. And then another guy's got his helmet right under his chin. And as he's going back with all three, you know, body this way, body this way, body this way, three different directions, you know, he gets the ball off. And we got about a 20-yard gain on the thing. It's the greatest completion I've ever seen in my life, because they've got him drilled simultaneously by three different people. And it's the best completion I ever saw. But he, real competitive guy, You know, he's got all that pretty boy stuff going, but he's a remarkable he's a remarkably tough person. I mean, he might be the toughest quarterback I've ever had, because I mean, we weren't able to protect him real well. He got at that point in time, and I mean, it'd be just one thing after the next. I remember one time we played Colorado, and he had 16 stitches. He had 16 stitches in his arm, and so we're playing Colorado. Those stitches pop open, and rather than, you know, a bunch of elaborate halftime adjustments with Cliff, Cliff's getting his arm restitched to go out there and play the second half. He really was a tough guy.
How do you feel about the Northwestern lawsuit and legally paying football players?
You know, I think that I think there's a couple things. I think I don't have a big problem with giving players more. You know, I mean, a bunch of money's being made in college football, and then and I think it's a reaction to a variety of things. I think one is all this money's being made in college football, and players want more money, which to me that's fine. Just make it even and make it so it's easy enough to administer, and we don't need to have bidding wars like you get more money in this conference or that team than the other team. I think it needs to be the same, whatever they arrive at. I think that I don't think they're professionals. I mean, if you think they're professionals coming out of high school, if you need to wire your house, go get you don't need to hire an electrician. Just go get some kid that was in the science club in high school and have him wire your house, you know. And because, hey, he's a professional, you know. And then the other thing is I think that one thing I don't understand on the Northwestern lawsuit, and I just need to look at it, is why it only applies to private institutions. Seems to me it'd be the other way around, and I'm not sure exactly why it shook out that way. I haven't seen student athletes so quick to pay federal income tax. And so I think part of it has to do with the fact that the NCAA is trying to cover an awful lot of bases when you consider the difference between a major 1A football team and say, for example, a Division III team. It's one size doesn't fit all, and I think there's going to be a time where they have to adjust it, though, so that, in other words, split it up in a fashion that they can really do justice to the different entities that don't really have a ton in common. And then I think that they need to give the players more. And I think that, you know, but all this, you know, professional, well, if they're that professional, number one, that means you get to give guys raises or you get to cut guys whenever you want to. You can fire them. And then I jokingly said this publicly, although if it worked out this way, I wouldn't mind, you know. Well, that means if they're professionals, that means we'll have a draft, you know. That means that number one running back in the nation, you know, this business of USC, Penn State, Florida. Well, you're going to go to Northwestern, Southwestern, Molly Putts, because they have the first pick in the draft. That's where you're going to go, you know. And then so I think it's mainly saber rattling. I think that. If they actually did distribute the athletes in a fashion like that, where they had a draft, some of these guys at Northwestern pushing for that lawsuit wouldn't be playing. I mean, if all of a sudden big schools don't get to hog all the really good athletes, well, then all of a sudden some of these guys at Northwestern, they're not playing; they're replaced. But I am in favor, though, of increasing what they're getting. But I will say this, I don't see guys starving. My players aren't starving. You know, they get their meals covered, and they get their meals covered, and they go to the cafeteria, or they have their card, or they get per diem on the weekends. And you know, if you're on a full scholarship, you're not starving. Now, there is the occasional instance where, you know, their family's in such a distressed situation that they may be giving scholarship money to other family members. And if that's the case, you know, and they're trying to help them out, and I can understand that, but the scholarship's designed for them, not, you know, the extended family. So, but hope they get more.
Top one more question, Coach.
Yeah.
Any more questions for the coach?
Do you ever see yourself returning possibly to the practice of law after you give up coaching?
I thought about that until I got to University of Kentucky, and I really don't. And I'm not against it. It's just it seems like it would be pretty tough to kind of get it all established. You know, I mean, law, like any profession, and like coaching or any of that, you develop your skills. You know, you learn it, you study it. You know, there's people that have dedicated all kinds of time and their lives to it to the point where, you know, fine, I went to law school, but there's a big difference between going to law school and devoting yourself to it for a period of time to really develop the best you can. I think that I suspect I'll coach, might write another book, who knows, but I have the utmost respect for law, and I think that and my daughter, who's a doctor, I make it clear to her and her husband periodically that lawyers prey on doctors, not the other way around. And I'm having fun coaching and look forward to that. That's the thing with coaching. There's always the next play, the next season, the next game, and pretty soon you just keep stacking one after the next, and it's kind of an exciting journey, an exciting ride. With that said, I'm truly honored to be here. Thanks so much for having me.